Welcome to the ocean of here and now. The ocean that from this particular place called a warm jewel temple and this particular time called the fourth day of Sesshin, the middle. In this particular time and place, it looks like this ocean is circular. Like the edges of the temple that we see and the edges of the fourth day bounded by the third day and the fifth day. It looks like a little circle called the fourth day of Sesshin at Warm Jewel Temple. But the ocean we heard this morning from Dogen is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It's like a boundless palace, like an inconceivable jewel. It only looks circular as far as our eye of practice can see. Ken gave me this magazine called Nautilus. It's unusual in that it doesn't really say anywhere what the magazine's about. Maybe in the back there's a little paragraph that's kind of like a science magazine. Almost like an artistic science magazine, I'd say. Nicely done. And this particular issue is kind of a collection of articles by different people, scientists and others, on consciousness. And one of them is an article about a woman named Lauren Marks who had a stroke. And I think many people have heard the story of Jill Bolte Taylor a few years ago, who had a stroke and took that as kind of a spiritual awakening to her stroke, and I think it became a very popular TED talk. So maybe this happens to many people, because this is another article that's very similar, but I thought it was beautiful reading her words. Because they reminded me of Sesshin, her stroke. So this is, she just totally unexpectedly one day, as a young woman, had some sort of brain aneurysm and woke up in the hospital and then with many stroke victims, there's many, many months of reintegrating and kind of retraining one's brain to function normally again. So for her, it was a lot about, she lost language and so on. But she was, we might look at a person like that and feel like they've lost some of their humanness or the good things of their life. But from her perspective, she was just fine. The people around her were really concerned about her. So she's describing now, after she's a very eloquent writer when she got the language back. Um, She's describing her memories of this time in the hospital just after her stroke. She says, all of these things that were going on around me in the hospital must have been confusing to me, but when I think of this time, I remember more clarity than confusion. I remember the quiet. This was not a quiet I had ever known before. It was a placid current, a presence more than an absence. Everything I saw or touched or heard pulsed with a marvelous sense of order. I had a nothing mind, a flotsam mind. I was incredibly focused on the present, with very little awareness or interest in my past or future. My entire environment felt interconnected, like cells in a large breathing organism. To experience this quiet was to be it. Whenever she writes quiet here, she writes it with a capital Q. To experience this quiet was to be it. She goes on, transformation felt abundant. Once fixed concepts like wall and window weren't as easy to identify anymore, and the differences between he and she and I and it were becoming indistinguishable. I knew my parents were my parents and my friends were my friends, but I felt less like myself and more like everything around me. You can see it's kind of somewhat selective, right? It's not like she's a vegetable or anything close to that, right? She's very conscious, very present. She can even identify parents and friends, and maybe on a kind of like almost energetic level, things that we resonate with energetically, like people that we know. Maybe she recognized the faces. She says, at this point, I didn't know much about my brain injury at all. I wasn't in any pain. So my thoughts about my new condition were unfocused and fleeting. Instead of being occupied by questions about why I was in the hospital and what had happened to me, my mind was engrossed in an entirely different set of perceptions. The smallest of activities would enthrall me. Dressing myself, I was awed by the orbital distance between cloth and flesh. Brushing my teeth, I was enchanted by the stiffness of the bristles and the sponginess of my gums. I also spent an inordinate amount of time looking out the window. My view was mainly of the hospital's rooftop with its gray and untextured panels, though I developed a lot of interest in a nearby tree. I could only make out the tops of the branches, but I'd watched this section of needles and boughs intently, fascinated by how the slightest wind would change the shape entirely. It was always and never the same tree. Very few things disturbed me during this period of time. So, just, I think a beautiful description. And maybe a little like Sashin. Maybe the left side of our brain is taking more of a break this week. And our right side, it's more more just present and receptive, is more awake. I thought in her story too, at some point the people came and like language therapists trying to help her regain the language, and she was perfectly willing to go along with that program, and but not like, yeah, I got to get the language back, but more like, yeah, we can do that. and she says, and I really didn't care whether how much progress I was making with that, and whether I'd ever learn the language or not, because I was just pretty content just in the present. But the trainers around me had this agenda, right? They're supposed to be training me to learn the language. So they would get frustrated with my, when I was progressing slowly, and they would be happy when I was progressing quickly. But I wasn't. I really didn't care about that, she'd say. But when they were frustrated, especially really frustrated, or, you know, maybe family with close ones would be, particularly in some pain, if she wasn't joining their program, their world of language, and you got to be a, you know, functioning member of society like us, maybe they felt and wanted for her, and she felt when they would be sad or upset, then that would affect her emotionally, but not because she wasn't learning the language, but because they were upset. How interesting, huh? It's like almost like a bodhisattva. Like, I'm not really upset by things, but when other people are upset, that actually I start feeling they're upset too, because I feel this intuitive resonance and connection with them. So for her, it was this way of presence was brought on by this accident of, I guess a stroke is usually like blood is not getting to certain areas of the brain. Certain areas of the brain that cause all our frustration and reified conceptual thought are not getting fed in the same way. And, you know, and those around such a one want to fix that as quickly as possible. And so that's kind of about brain, the physical brain affecting the mind. But it's hard to know exactly which way this works. Earlier in Sesshin, we heard Keizan Zenji saying that mind transforms and becomes body. Or it was also translated as the body appears in mind. And so there's another article in this whole issue about consciousness by a Norwegian philosopher and postdoctoral researcher, and maybe also into neurobiology, Hedda Hasselmork, and another woman. So she's talking about the brain-mind connection. So the physical brain is part of the body, and the mind, and how most people, neurobiologists and scientists in general, see the brain as kind of like hardware, and the mind is like software. When we think of like a computer, right? The physical drive is what we call the hardware that makes it work, and then the software, like the programs that make things actually happen, that they're not physical, actually. Programs are not physical. So that's the kind of standard model that maybe not just scientists, but most people might have. Physical brains like hardware, and the non-physical mind is like the software of our being. And then, you know, it's a long and complex article here, but she says we can also explore through experiments and experiences, looking at this differently. She says, it may be suggested that consciousness of some primitive and rudimentary form, maybe not as the gross consciousness that we negotiate the world with, a kind of primitive rudimentary form of consciousness, may be the hardware that the software described by physics runs on. So she's suggesting that it's maybe the other way around, that non-physical consciousness is like the hardware, and the brain and the physics of the electrical activity in the brain and so on is more like the software. The physical world, she says, can be conceived of as a structure of conscious experiences. Our own richly textured experiences implement the physical relations that make up our brains. This is really kind of this reversal view, right? Our richly textured experiences implement the physical relationships that make up our brains. Some simple elementary forms of experiences implement the relations that make up fundamental particles. Take an electron, for example. What an electron does is to attract, repel, and otherwise relate to other entities in accordance with fundamental physical equations. So an electron is a relational particle, right? It makes up an atom. But it's what it basically does is to relate to other entities. What performs this behavior, we might think, is simply a stream of tiny electron experiences. Electrons and other particles could be thought of, as mental beings with physical powers, as streams of experience in physical relations to other streams of experience. This idea sounds strange, she says, even mystical, but it comes out of a careful line of thought about the limitations of science. And Bertrand Russell was one who was really exploring this possibility. And a 17th century scientist, Leibniz, who were very rational scientists, but as they looked more and more into how things work, they started to open to this possibility. She says, for this reason, conscious experiences are just the kind of things that physical structure could be the structure of. Given this solution to the hard problem of matter, the hard problem of consciousness all but dissolves. There's no longer any question of how consciousness arises from non-conscious matter, which is, I think, this is maybe what's called the hard problem of consciousness. How could this non-material experiencing arise from physical matter? With all our incredibly advanced science, nobody's really getting any closer to that. Or maybe they feel like they're getting closer, but many would propose, and I would agree, that no matter what kind of advanced scientific instruments humans will invent in the billions of years to come, this gap between how physical matter produces this, I propose, will never be found, because it's not actually like that. So she says, there's no longer any question of how consciousness arises from non-conscious matter, because all matter is intrinsically conscious. There's no longer a question of how consciousness depends on matter, because it is matter that depends on consciousness. as relations depend on relata, structure depends on realizer, or software on hardware. So sometimes it's hard to crack all the scientist language and how they put things, but it does sound strange to us, I think, in our culture of kind of that's based on the material is the material world is reality, and consciousness is sort of this random sort of byproduct that somehow arose out of this stuff. And of course, she's not the only one. Patrick and I attended the Science and Non-Duality Conference, where basically many, many scientists all are coming from the same point of view. Yeah. She'd be fit in there nicely. So this session we're looking at this 13th century manual of Zazen practice, what to be aware of in Zazen, guidelines for sitting meditation by Keizan Jokin Daisho, or kind of co-founder of Soto Zen in Japan, along with Dogen. And we've heard about how Zazen is going right into the ocean of awareness, and it's illumining the mind ground and manifesting the original face, revealing the scenery of the basic ground, and so on. We've heard of the exalted praise of the ungraspable, inconceivable, indescribable Buddha Dharma of Zazen. So now, and of course some of you missed some of that description, but it's inconceivable and ineffable. Anyway, you know, it's the ocean of here and now. So today, Keizan takes like a little turn, getting much more practical. We could say that so far he's mostly been describing the ocean and celebrating the ocean of the all-pervading, ever-present here now. And now he's going to start exploring the waves that are made of the ocean, but also the waves that we can relate to and kind of guide in order to reveal the clarity of the ocean. Keizan says, if you want to cease confusion, you must cease involvement in thoughts of good or bad. They often, it seems to be a Zen theme, right? Give up this good and bad and right and wrong and so on. And I don't think this is meant to undermine the Bodhisattva precepts and so on. We I think, when we're in the mind of Zazen, we naturally respond kindly to others and take care of relationships with others, beings in this world, pretty nicely. So it's more like when we're trying to figure everything out very conceptually, especially during Zazen, I think it's when they really say give up thoughts of good and bad and right and wrong, I think especially saying during Zazen practice. Maybe that because those dichotomies are some of the main ways that the conceptual mind gets really activated and really kind of reified and solidified is in these strong dichotomies. That's wrong, or that's bad, or that's good. So maybe it just stands for all kinds of dualistic thinking, really. Keizan says, just stop getting caught up in unnecessary affairs. A mind not thinking together with a body not doing is the essential point to remember. Essential point here is Yojin. This essay is called Zazen Yojin Ki. So it's the essential, it's the guideline to remember. Interestingly, it may be the only place in this long essay that he actually uses the phrase Yojin, as like, which means literally to use the mind, how you use the mind, but as a compound it means like guidelines. So it's just one of the many phrases, but we could see this as, we could take it as the main Yojin is a mind not thinking and a body not doing is the, how to use the mind is Zazen practice. Of course, we think during Zazen, right? But we don't have to pick up the train of thought and get a hold of it. I can watch it flow by as the scenery of the original ground. And body not doing, we could say our heart's beating and our lungs are breathing and when the bell rings, we get up for kinhin. So it's not literally not moving at all, but it's, we might say giving up the kind of intentionally trying to change the thought or the body in Zazen, letting it all be. When delusive involvements end, the mind of delusion ceases. When delusion ceases, the essence of true body that was always the case manifests, and it is always clearly aware. The reality that was always the case manifests, and it is always clearly aware. It's not a matter of total cessation or of activity. It's not like nothing can happen at all, and it's not like it's just activity happening. So now comes Keizan getting into like a whole section about activities to, you know, be careful of, about clothing and food and where to sit, the environment for sitting, and breath and body and mind. So all these practicalities, some waves. So maybe I'll preface this section on these activities to avoid with saying, we have to remember the context. Not only is this 13th century, but he's talking to a group of monks and maybe that are in retreat. And so it sounds like, well, these are all the things we like to do. But so I hear it as maybe it is like in Sesshin. It's nice to read this in Sesshin. In Sesshin, we actually do give up most of this stuff if we're really here for the duration. And it's really about simplifying, I think, when all the activities of our usual life, we just simplify, like in the Sesshin guidelines that we read at the first period and are posted outside. Various things like this list that we we encourage to support our practice, and it says something like, avoid reading, writing, photography, and phone calls, I think maybe is part of our list. And at some point, after some sessions of reading that, I thought, well, it's not just like that we're, you know, why are we doing this? Why do we refrain from such things? Not just to be austere or something. So I actually added in a sentence there to the guidelines that says, explains it. It says, to experience the simplicity of the moment. And maybe we can, you know, if we're taking a photo as an artist, I think that also is a way to experience the simplicity of the moment. And so everything on this list, when you hear it, pretty much, I think, can be seen in this way. But the way Keizan puts it is, avoid getting caught up in arts and crafts, prescribing medicines and fortune-telling. Stay away from singing and dancing, arguing and babbling, fame and gain. And so, why did he single out these ones? They don't seem so bad, right? Arts and crafts. And I thought, well, maybe it's because there are all these Zen arts, actually. And so the monks in the monastery maybe were into arts and crafts. They weren't into, like, all kinds of horrible debauchery, right? They were, but he's saying for sesshin, even if we're into arts and crafts, we can, like, put it all aside. But I really would say that I think the reason that arts and crafts are connected with Zen is because they are a Dharma gate to experiencing the simplicity of the present. They can be. And same with music and dance. Especially if we're doing them completely. At some point, like living in Tassajara, they actually have a guideline for the 3-month practice periods of not listening to music. And for some people, that's like a major thing. And there were some professional musicians who would come with their instruments. You don't practice playing music or listening to it, even on headphones, not just to not disturb others, but some people, that was like a major challenge. I love music. And I came to Tassajara loving music, so it was kind of hard, but I did come to appreciate it as a practice. You start hearing the sounds of the wind as music, and the sounds of the stream as music. And then at some point, I thought, well, maybe now that I've gotten used to that, it was okay to let go of that. It's not like it's some inherent problem with music. Let's see about bringing it back in. And how would I like to bring it back in? And I remember at Tassajara thinking, if I'm going to listen to music, I'm going to treat it as a practice of just listening to music. In other words, not like sort of maybe cleaning the house while I put on some music in the background. Or some, maybe people will leave the TV on in the background because it's comforting to have this voice and babbling in the background. But I think that's what we're doing all day long. Kind of we're creating this multi-sensory field of bombardment. So not that I never get into that kind of thing either, but I do like to, if I'm listening to music, I just appreciate it most if I'm really just stop doing anything else and just sit there and listen to the, like, really, like, receive it. It's so beautiful, right? So then it becomes a little bit more like Zazen. Total presence with music. Or dancing is a great way to be embodied and in the present with music, right? I still like dancing to live music. I like classical music and I love rock and roll. And especially when it's so loud that the conceptual mind can't remember how to think. And the body can move with the music in a non-conceptual way. It really, dancing to live music, I think many people feel like, is very similar to Zazen. Anyways, especially like, I am someone who is, as I mentioned before, have a very active conceptual mind. So, I can spend hours and hours non-stop, like, reading intricacies of Dharma and researching each footnote, you know. So sometimes for me then, it's time to go dancing. and this is Buddha Dharma now. That was like, on the fourth hour of reading that book, I've lost touch with the ocean of here and now. But now I remember it again. So, you know, with all due respect to Kazan, sometimes these things can be distracting from the present. And sometimes they can enliven the present. Composing poetry, Kazan says, can be an aid in clarifying the mind, but don't get caught up in it. He gives a little more credit to poetry writing. But don't spend 4 hours doing it. The same is true for writing and calligraphy. I guess he had to give himself the out there because he wrote this whole thing. This is the superior precedent for practitioners of the way and is the best way to harmonize the mind. Don't wear fine, luxurious clothing or dirty old rags. It's kind of a middle way thing. Fine, luxurious clothing gives rise to greed and then the fear that someone will steal it. This is a hindrance to practitioners of the way. Even if someone offers them to you, to refuse is the excellent tradition from ancient times. Whew. If you happen to have luxurious clothing, don't be concerned with it. If it's stolen, don't bother to chase after it or regret its loss. Maybe that's the main point is with all of this stuff is, are we like overly attached to things? Well, we're really going to suffer if they disappear. And if not, then maybe no problem. But I thought that's pretty strong. If someone offers you nice robes, to refuse them is the excellent tradition from ancient times. Sometime last year, a friend of mine did offer me a fine priest robe that she had, you know, left over, and it was a kind gift. And I did think about it at the time, like, well, actually, I don't really need this. But it also didn't feel quite right to just refuse it. Also, she was trying to kind of like unload some extra robes, take it off her hands, right? She's maybe trying to practice this, give this stuff away. So I think the point is, we're not seeking for something that we don't have, and we're not so concerned about it. Stuff comes and goes, right? The waves on the ocean arise and cease. It's okay. And I think, personally, I think it's nice to receive things and then you can just give them away again. Because then we'll get to cycle the giving. Old dirty clothes should be washed and mended. Clean them thoroughly before putting them on. If you don't take care of them, you might get cold and sick, and this will hinder your practice. So maybe if they get so threadbare that it's the wind is coming through. So he's kind of saying, avoid the like fancy robes. Of course, I think actually it's a funny thing in Zen that I've always like never been so comfortable with is the Zen priests, the home leavers, have like all these robes and they're like with all these pleats and they're kind of complicated, right? And they're kind of expensive. Some of them we make ourselves, but in Japan they usually don't even make them. Even the hand sewn ones for us are like they buy in the store in Japan, and they're expensive. And it's supposed to be a kind of renunciation thing. It's a patched robe made up of Buddha's time was just scraps from the garbage pile sewn together because you can only find scraps this big. So it's funny how customs change, right? And it's the like patched robes, but sometimes in Japan they're like these super fancy brocade patterns, hand, you know, woven with dragons and Garudas and clouds and multicolors on these like patched robes representing Buddha's like total like simplicity and renunciation. It's a funny thing. I think in America we don't get quite as caught up in it as they do in Japan, but people are always looking for ways to kind of simplify all that stuff. And so Keizan's kind of saying, really avoid the, even don't even receive nice robes, just dirty ones. I thought, well, that's a little bit one-sided. So here's Dogen in the Shobogenza Zui Monkey, where his student, Kon Ejo, asks, these are like, you know, monks talking, but you could say the principle applies to all of us. Ejo asked, as an activity for Zen practitioners, mending or patching old tattered clothing instead of throwing it away actually seems to be clinging to things. It seems to be attachment to that old robe. We want to keep it going and not, you know, we like this old robe. And maybe even the more patches, the more cherished it is. Sometimes I think the monastery I practiced in Japan, there was that style, especially for going out on the begging rounds. People had special robes that were, it was nice not to wear your best robes out on the muddy street, so that have these really, really patched koromos and I think when they were really, really patched, people did think they were pretty cool. I thought they were kind of cool. Cooler than the new ones, actually. So Ajo's kind of picked up on that and like, seems like mending or patching the old tattered clothes instead of just throwing it away seems to be attachment to that old robe. Yet, abandoning the old clothing and wearing new robes shows that we're seeking after new things. Both of these seem wrong. Ultimately, what should we do, Dogen? This is the kind of thing they were concerned about sometimes. The waves, you know? Yeah, I mean, they were into that too. But when they're chatting over tea, they're like, well, how do we take care of the waves on this ocean to accord with the ocean? We might say these little details of like, which one should we... They both seem like attachment. Which one? What should we do? Yes, you could see it as it's kind of like how do we make the every detail of our life in accord with the ocean of non-duality. So Ejo asked this question, and Dogen replies, "Well, if we're free from holding on to what we have, and yet not seeking after what we don't have." Either way is all right. In other words, you can have really fine, nice clothes or tattered rags. The point is about non-attachment and non-seeking. I mean, maybe obvious, but people maybe trying to figure out the details of how it should play out in the material world. So Dogen nicely turns it, it's just about your mind anyway, really. And then after that, either way, as long as you're not attached, but then he kind of follows it up. Maybe as Edjo is like leaving the room, like, cool, either way. Dogen says, still, it would be better to mend the old clothing, keep it for as long as possible, and not try to get new stuff. He kind of leans that way a little bit. Which kind of makes sense, right? It's like practical. Keep it simple. So Keizan says, although we shouldn't be too anxious about bodily comforts, inadequate clothing, food, and sleep are known as the three insufficiencies, and they will cause our practice to suffer. So, you know, we don't need to, like, get totally excessively indulging in extra clothing, food, and sleep. But here he emphasizes, if we don't have enough clothing, food, and sleep, these are the three inadequacies. So it's all the middle way. Some might feel like in Sesshin it's impossible to get adequate sleep. We get up too early and go to sleep too late. But I think we can find our way, you know, on breaks and so on. Just right, I think. We can just do it. And Orioki, our Orioki bowls, our eating bowls in Sesshin, and the word Orioki means just enough container. The just enough container. So again, we get just about right with food and sleep and clothing. We might say it's about the temperature. So sometimes it might feel cool in here, but sometimes it might feel hot in here, but we can adjust our clothing and make it just about right. So then he goes into the food section. Don't eat anything alive, hard, or spoiled. So like something squirming along, like, don't eat it while it's alive. So I don't know what he means, whether it just means like living beings, or I think another translation here is raw, alive, maybe like uncooked. And hard could be translated as unripe. So, or spoiled. Such impure foods will make your belly churn and cause heat and discomfort of body and mind, making your sitting difficult. So we all have different things. I mentioned the other day that stewed fruit, like prunes, sometimes make my belly churn if I have too much. So we just find, each person's going to be different. We find our middle way, and the tenzos help us very nicely, serving us pure food. Keizan said, don't indulge in rich or fancy foods. Not only is this bad for our body and mind, it's just greedy. You should eat to support life, so don't fuss about the taste. So we say in our meal chant, we eat to support life and to practice the way of Buddha. He's being kind of strict here, I think. But I think it's fine to enjoy the food too, but it is nice to remember, which I often forget, that the main reason we're eating is to support life, right? I think restaurants are not built on this principle. Maybe dancing and singing are not necessarily built on that principle, but they can be used that way. Going to a good restaurant and really savoring and enjoying the food, it can be a Dharma gate to entering the present experience in all its regal glory. Also, if you sit after eating too much, you'll feel ill. Maybe anyone who's been practicing for a while knows this a little bit. Whether the meal is large or small, wait a little while before sitting. And we do. We build our schedule here around our break times are after meals. It's not just coincidence, right? And I think it's really true when some places might have like a schedule where you just go right back to zazen after a meal. And sometimes I've tried just, you know, in my break, just going right back to zazen. And it's usually not the best zazen. It's usually like kind of sleepy because the body's digesting and we feel kind of heavier. So I like how Keizan says, even if you're just sitting on your own, like right after eating, doesn't seem like, I've never thought of it as a naturally good time to sit zazen. Mendicant monks should be moderate in eating and hold their portions to 2/3 of what they can eat. Maybe for sesshin, we maybe do tend to eat a little bit less in sesshin. I eat a little bit less. I still think I probably eat a little more than I need to in sesshin because they offer such nice food. It's so delicious. And I notice I sometimes take more when I really like it. I mean, all this is okay, but sometimes we just watch cause and effect. Sometimes I do notice, like, that was great, but then even an hour later, like, maybe I didn't need to eat quite that much. And in daily life, I confess I never eat 2/3 of my fill. I eat a lot. I don't know if I have a fast metabolism or what, but the main point is what's supporting our presence and ease and simplicity and well-being. All healthy foods and medicines, sesame, wild yams, and so on can be eaten. I don't know why he singles those out, but maybe that's why we have gamashio every day, because Keizan approves of sesame. Essentially, you should harmonize the body in this way, harmonize or tune the body in this way through clothing and food. And these activities, you know, pay attention to what activities we're doing on breaks and in our whole life, really. Sometimes I think that our usual notion is that we do zazen to support our life, and we set up a zazen schedule to support the activities of our life. But sesshin is almost like reversing those. So we set up our daily life to support zazen. And sesshin's unusual in that way. And we really, I think, all do feel that. We have to really arrange the practicalities of our life, putting many things aside in order to sit zazen. Strange thing. So maybe hard to do that all the time, although, you know, it's an inspiring thought to me to try to, you know, head that direction in whatever ways I can to actually try to arrange my life to support zazen, even outside of sesshin. We have a full, you know, schedule of daily zazen and so on, and so we really can arrange things around sitting, and we're just planning our whole 2018 calendar at the Zen Center, and some of us are really like arranging our lives, arranging our 2018 around Sasan. And then I think then we have this time off too, and I'm thinking, how can I, in my so-called vacation time, how can I fit how can I use that for Zazen? I often take my vacations, do other Zazen retreats at other places. So, life becomes strange sometimes after a while as a Zen practitioner. Zazen is high maintenance. Yeah. Totally. Sashin really does seem such a thing. It's all about priorities and perspective, right? All these useful things we kind of arrange and maybe simplify in order to have a lot of time to do this really useless thing. Zazen. When you're sitting in Zazen, don't prop yourself up against the wall, a meditation brace or screen. Sometimes we do. We provide chairs for leaning back, and I think depending on each person's body, we find a way that's comfortable and supportive to sit and breathe openly. So I think it's kind of like if we don't need to lean against anything, then just an upright, unsupported body is nice. Also, don't sit in windy places or high exposed places, as this can cause illness. This is also quoting from Dogen's teacher, Ru Jing, telling Dogen, sometimes I do sit outside, sometimes it might end up being like a windy place or the wind comes up, and I do notice that, and I have thought about these instructions, that it is, actually it's pretty hard to sit if it's like noticeably windy. On a hot day, a little breeze is just perfect for sitting, but if it's really like windy, even though it might be, if we're hiking, it's just refreshing, but if we sit down and do Zazen, it's just, I think it's just about the stillness. Wind is really this moving energy, and it's like a lot more sensory input than we're used to in Zazen. Sometimes when you're sitting Zazen, you may feel hot or cold, discomfort or ease, stiff or loose, heavy or light, sometimes startled, wide awake. All these sensations arise through disharmonies of mind and breath. Interestingly. Harmonize your breath in this way. Open your mouth slightly. Allow long breaths to be long and short breaths to be short, and it will harmonize gradually and naturally. Follow your breath for a while until a sense of awareness arises and your breath will be natural. After this, then just continue to breathe naturally through the nose. So this is like little details now, but that's an interesting one. This is kind of like sort of yogic practice points about if these feeling agitated or even startled, wide awake, he's saying this is actually an imbalance of body and breath. We want to be alert, awake, and settled, and to tune or harmonize the breath. Open your mouth just a little, which we usually don't in Zazen. Just a little, and let the breath pass through the mouth, letting long breath be long and short be short. And when we come to a sense of awakeness and awareness, then we can close our mouth again. So these are things we can play with, try out. Because we got plenty of time in Zazen to try out all kinds of things. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.